We wrapped up a short week heading into the July 4th holiday weekend on Thursday, July 2nd, right here on Connecticut Today. In the 3 o'clock hour, we talked about all these statues and monuments coming down all across the U.S. with a Washington, D.C.-based political consultant. Will this help or hurt one party or the other heading into the November election? 4 o'clock hour, we gave you a segment of Governor Ned Lamont's latest coronavirus media update in which he talked about delaying opening and reopening for bars across the state. And in the 5 o'clock hour, one of our regulars, commuter columnist Jim Cameron, joined us to talk about the state of commuting as most people go back to work in Connecticut and into New York. And also, Jim gave us his thoughts on what the General Assembly is doing or not doing in this time of COVID-19. Political consultant and the CEO of X Strategies, Alex Brusewitz, is with us. He wants to chime in on that. Alex, hi. Paul here at WICC. How are you?
Doing well, Paul. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm all right on Thursday, heading into a long weekend. This whole, and you're a D.C.-based consultant, this whole statues thing, monuments coming down, being torn down, a lot of people say, well, it's about time. We should have done this long ago. A lot of people say, well, wait a minute. It's history. History's ugly. Leave them up there. We'll talk about them. Where do you fall on this?
Well, you know, I personally don't get offended by a statue, and I think those that do definitely have some issues going on. Our country isn't perfect. We don't have a perfect history. We've definitely made some mistakes, but times change. Mm-hmm. But you can't delete the past. You can't erase the past. And if you forget about the past, if these statues come down and we don't get taught about this stuff anymore, we're doomed to repeat it. And so, you know, I listened to a heartbreaking story of a woman from Venezuela talking about how when Chavez rose to power in Venezuela, first thing that he started doing, taking down their history, deleting, you know, getting rid of their statues. And it didn't just stop at political statues. It started becoming religious statues. And that's what socialists and communists do.
Yeah, that video of her, I forgot her name, Alex, but it certainly has taken on a life of its own. It really is, I noticed, trending in the social media world. It popped up a couple of days, and I read what she said. I listened to what she said, and I kind of remember, yeah, I mean, that is kind of the first thing. And nobody's saying there's, you know, a Central American takedown here, but that is kind of the first thing that goes, all the symbolism, I guess, of the past.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right, and it's Venezuela. It was the Soviet Union. It's you know, it happened in China. It happened in Cuba, and these people, this ideology, it's an evil ideology, socialism. They want to erase our history, and they just can't do that. And it's not stopping at the statues. It's already, you know, trickled into TV and entertainment. They're canceling shows like Paw Patrol and, you know, the deleting movies like Gone with the Wind. And, you know, these people really, at the end of the day, they just don't have a goal in mind. They just want complete chaos. They just want to keep going until somebody tells them to stop. And the president is the only person saying, hey, you can't do this. Cut it out. And Republicans, a lot of Republicans aren't standing up to the mob. And, you know, we really need the adults in the room to step up and tell the kids to go to the room.
You know, the president always talks about, he thinks the silent majority is out there watching. He says, listen, you may be upset with me, but come November, you'll see. And you and I both know the poll numbers for him are not good right now. Mr. Biden, undoubtedly, would be elected if the election were held today. Do you think this whole controversy, Alex, do you think that this plays out as a net positive for the president or not?
I do think so. I think that there's, you know, 10,000 pounds with the community that I grew up in. I grew up in a town of 7,000 people. And we people in communities like the one I grew up in, they look at what's going on in these major cities. And everybody can recognize that these cities are all run by Democrats. All, you know, the major cities, except for a couple, are run by Democrats. And, you know, a Democrat presidency, it would be like that in every city across the country. And 10,000 small towns in America, they respect law enforcement, they respect our history, they respect our, you know, country, they respect our flag, and they see these anarchists, the president correctly labels them domestic terrorists, destroying communities, And, you know, I also look at the mothers who have young children who like the show Paw Patrol, and now these kids need to find their, you know, find entertainment in something else, and the moms can't be happy about that. So I think that silent majority is going to come out big time in November, and I also do think the polls are a little skewed.
What about the people, though, on the other side, Alex, who say, listen, you know what, we understand history being history, but okay, take these monuments, put them in a, put them in a museum, put them in somewhere where somebody would have to make the effort to go and see them. They're not out in the open where people would be, and I hate to use the word, but, you know, people would be offended by these. What are your thoughts on that?
Come on, that's just an issue with these people. If you look at a bronze statue and think, oh, wow, that offends me, you have to have some, you know, you have to seek help. I'm sorry to say it, but that's, you need to seek help. And, you know, you can't just be offended by a statue. And it's not even, you know, the Confederates that they're going after. They're going after Abraham Lincoln. These people, you know, they want every bronze statue in the country taken down, whether it's a, you know, Abraham Lincoln or Robert E. Lee or whoever it is. They want it all gone. And, you know, I don't think that we should even give an inch to the mob, because we give an inch, they'll take everything.
Why do you think there's no discernment, Alex, among these groups? Why do you think that we don't see a scenario of, well, listen, we're just trying to take down the Southern generals. Yeah, Lincoln was good. We're going to keep him there. Why does this seem to be, Alex, kind of a bulldozer mentality here? What do you think the reason is for that?
There is an education system that has failed generations in this country. An education system with history teachers that are as liberal as they can possibly be. These history teachers, many of which, you know, I had many growing up, and that's how I got started in politics. I got started in politics because Scott Walker took on the teachers union in Wisconsin, and all of my liberal teachers went down and marched on the Capitol. And I was like, wow, this Scott Walker guy really makes these teachers mad, and I don't like these teachers.
So you thought that was a pretty good thing, huh? I like that.
Oh, 100%. But these teachers are as leftist as they come, and they're in every classroom, in every school in America, from K through 12 to through universities, uh-huh. And they brainwash students. And there's a generation of students that were raised to hate this country. There's a generation of students that truly believe America is a racist country. There's a generation of students that believe, you know, reparations are due. And it's really a sad state. And a lot of these anarchists, most of these protesters, they're not even black, right? These are white liberals who say that Robert E. Lee offends them. And, like, come on.
And it's sad that, Alex, that, you know, you see videos in these cities and these protests of, you know, black protesters who are out, you know, peaceful protesters yelling and screaming at some of these, you know, white, for lack of a better word, you know, suburban kids and yuppies saying, you know, stop doing damage in our name. I mean, there's nothing worse, Scott, than I saw during those protests of, you know, white suburban kids spray painting BLM everywhere. And then, you know, you and I are meant to assume that that was done by black protesters. It makes no sense.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I feel bad for a lot of these suburban parents. Maybe they're going wrong or something. But, you know, these kids want to be part of something cool, and they think being anarchists are cool. They think, you know, hey, nobody's going to stop us, so let's go spray paint. Let's go get a group of our friends and take some Instagram pictures in front of burning buildings. That'll be cool, for social media, right?
Jeez.
That's what these kids think. And you saw it, you know, there's a very famous woman, Kendall Jenner, one of the Kardashian daughters. She went to a protest, and she, you know, she just held up a sign, and she photoshopped Black Lives Matter on the sign, and she posted it, and she got a million likes.
Oh.
Like, it's a social media trend that we need to put an end to. These people have no idea what they're protesting.
Yeah.
They have no idea who these statues are, and they have no end in mind. They're just going to keep going until someone says no.
Alex, tell us about your firm X Strategies, and what's the web address if people are interested?
Yeah, so the web address is xstrats.com, xstrats.com, and we work with about candidates and politicians across the country, try to get the strongest conservatives elected to Congress. Many of them have already won their primaries. We have about seven races in the state of Florida alone, whose primaries are coming up August 18th. But we're trying to get strong Trump Republicans elected to Congress and the Senate. And we also do a lot of work with conservative pundits, TV personalities, you name it.
So you can represent me nationally. Is that how it would work? I'm kidding. I can't ask you.
I could.
No, the boss is not payola. Can't do that. All right. Hey, Alex Brusewitz. Alex, thanks. Appreciate the time, buddy. Be good. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. Happy 4th.
Thanks, Alex. Happy 4th to you. X-Strategies, xstrats.com.
We're here. Hammonasset is open. Our parks are open. Our beaches are open. And if you look at the front page of the Houston Chronicle, it says, this July 4th weekend, stay home. Well, we're open because of each and every one of you doing the right thing. And I don't want to bore you with the numbers, but I'll tell you, again, yesterday, we did 11,000 tests. That means 80,000 tests for the week. We have plenty of capacity, but sometimes you have to encourage people to get tested these days. Maybe they're not showing symptoms. They feel like we're out of the woods. I think they thought that maybe down in Arizona and Texas and Florida a couple months ago. It reminds you to be cautious. The testing, those that tested positive, is less than 1%. It was 0.6%. So that's 7 days in a row of less than 1%. And don't take that for granted. Because you've seen what's going on around the rest of the country. You see how that can change fast. But you also, you can see the benefits of paying attention. I was just out walking in, on the beautiful beach, and everybody was being appropriate. Everybody was keeping their distance and making a difference. And as I was driving through here, I was sort of looking for license plates, seeing if there are any Florida plates or Arizona plates. We love you, but not this month, guys. And we did declare a quarantine about a week ago from those states that are most infected, those states like Florida and Arizona and now California, where they have pockets that have an infection rate that's 10, 20, even 30 times more than Connecticut. And I wish you all the best. I hope you maintain the protocols like we have here in Connecticut. You can bend the curve a second time. I can tell you, talking to our airlines here, when we issued the quarantine directive, the number of people making reservations coming up from, say, Florida and South Carolina went down about 20%. Number of cancellations went down. I don't say that with any great joy because we have hotels and tourism, and I don't wish ill on anybody, but it's keeping our state much, much safer. Our hotels are open for business. They're probably at 20% occupancy during the week, 50% on weekend, keeping that limited. We do welcome visitors to our state from the region. That's New York and Massachusetts and Rhode Island. Other states that, like us, have a positivity rate of 1%, give or take. So we can do that safely. But broadly speaking, I say staycation. Stay close to home. You've got a Hammonasset or something like this 15 minutes away, or as my security detail says, 10-minute drive away. And so it's worth the visit and taking advantage of our beautiful state. I'd like to leave you with one little message. A friend of mine named Roland Cook, who is our Commissioner of Corrections, is heading back to Utah. And, it's a tough job, corrections, especially in the middle of a COVID crisis. And there was a lot of critique, and there were a lot of lawsuits, and there were a lot of protests. And Roland, this is from me. I wish you all the best. We're going to miss you. And it's worth noting that Connecticut is the first state in the country to reduce the number of people incarcerated by over 50% in the last 10 years. 50% fewer people behind bars than there were before. And nothing is absolutely safe, but I also got to tell you, we've tested everybody in our corrections facilities. We have one of the very lowest infection rates anywhere in the country when it comes to correctional facilities. And I read one of the advocates who were suing us, and they said, well, maybe Connecticut just got lucky. And I say to Roland, and I say to the folks at corrections, and I say to the folks who are involved in health care at our correction facilities, the harder you work, the luckier you get. And it was your hard work that kept everybody safe in the corrections and throughout our state. And for that, I cannot be more thankful. And somebody's tugging on my pant leg, so I think. What's your name?
Nate.
Nate, you've come to the beach a lot?
Yep. Me and my grandfather bike here a lot, too.
Oh, boy. So you've lived here for a while. Your family has.
Oh, yeah.
You are very lucky.
We live in Brantford, but...
That's close enough. What's your name?
Grace.
Hey, Grace. Thanks for being here. Anyway, that's all I got to say, except to say happy July 4th. We're fortunate to be in this state and the situation we are right now. Enjoy it responsibly.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Nate. Bye, Grace.
Thank you, Governor. Any questions?
Perhaps this is for the Commissioner and the Governor. Could you give us an idea when inland state parks might be reopened to swimming again? I mean, that's an issue that I'm sure people are interested in this summer.
Thank you. Thanks for that question. So that's right. So since Memorial Day, when we announced we'd be starting swimming at the shoreline parks, we announced that we were not able to support reopening of swimming at our inland parks. But I can tell you, spent last week going out to visit some of the inland locations, really assessing what we can do to try to provide that later this summer. We're still evaluating that. We're consulting with public health and other experts. The issue with the inland swimming is not that there's a risk of transmission from swimming, but just that the size of those beaches at those ponds and lakes is much smaller than what you see here along the shoreline. So with the 15 feet of distance between blankets, it becomes difficult for us to accommodate many visitors. But we're looking at that. We're also, again, trying to evaluate what we can provide, because we know how important those locations are for folks, especially as the weather warms. And we're hopeful that our efforts to recruit more people to join us and our seasonal workforce, that's going to be another element of this, because to be able to open those locations for swimming, we also would need to have adequate staffing to do that. So again, that workoutdoors.ct.gov website, encourage people to check that out. But we are working hard and hope to have some updates on whether we'll be able to reopen those locations in the next few weeks. Environmental conservation officers, we're working closely with municipal officials to help us support enforcement around our outdoor recreation facilities across the state. We know that there are locations like Wadsworth that are getting tremendous pressure, a lot of use. We're working on that and trying to take action within, you know, the numbers of folks that we have to do that. But we appreciate everyone's, that's why we're trying to get the message out about what people can expect and not expect. That's inland swimming is not allowed at this time at our locations, and working to do everything we can to get compliance. Overall, people have been very understanding, but there are exceptions, and we're working to address them.
Governor, can I ask you a variation on, you said some remarks on New York radio today regarding the restaurants. So it seems like you're holding on the restaurants, but would you...
Governor, heading back to the podium here, asked about comments he made regarding restaurants and bars.
Bars in relation to social distancing, I mean, how important is this weekend in the way the state responds?
Yeah, so Ken was asking about phase three, indoor dining, bars, what comes next. This is an important weekend, not just for Connecticut, but I'm also looking around the rest of the country in terms of what the impact is. But I'm 100% with what Deirdre said. Most important thing I've learned is outdoors is much safer than indoors. You know, we thought a couple months ago, remember, the virus was going to go away as soon as it got warm. And then we realized in places like Houston, it's bloody hot to be outside, so a lot of people are indoors there. And maybe the air conditioning is circulating. That's probably one of the things that's causing a bit of a spike. So, yes, we're going to keep our restaurants at 50% capacity indoors. More importantly, I urge you to go outdoors. I urge you to take that outdoor dining every opportunity you can. It's just much, much safer. And Ken, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I think the bars are going to have to take a pause right now. I'm just looking around the rest of the country, and I've seen it's pretty infectious in there.
What's the level of concern amongst yourself and the commission, the Acting Commissioner of Public Health, about these beaches being open again? What's the level of concern?
I've walked around out there, Paul. I've seen people are keeping the distance. As I told Ken, the difference between indoors and outdoors is dramatic. And I feel very confident outdoors with the distancing, people are safe. I was terrified about the protests. I thought, my God, 1,000 people arm in arm. And you read right now that was outdoors, and there doesn't seem to be a big spike related to that. It's more of those indoor-type facilities where you see a lot of the spread, but Deirdre can add.
All right, that should be good. So there you go, Governor Ned Lamont saying that the bars are going to, quote-unquote, have to wait. He writes the Getting There column for Hearst Connecticut Media and also opines on other things, his latest column having to do with the state of politics here in the great state, the People's Republic of Connecticut. Jim Cameron joins us. Hi, Jim.
Oh, how are you?
I'm okay. I'm still broadcasting from the Wallingford Bureau, safely ensconced, social distancing, but I'm sure you are well as well, sir, from the Darien Bureau, yes.
Absolutely. The Bureau is well air-conditioned, and
yes.
We keep the circulation moving to make sure there are no untoward viruses floating about.
Air conditioning, as my friend, is a food group, as far as I'm concerned, so that's good. Goes on and goes on in April, goes off in October. Jim, before we get to your latest piece, taking our dear lawmakers to task here, more people going back to work. What have you been hearing, if anything, regarding our fine commuter rail system? I'm guessing they'll be seeing more volume, maybe. Is that already happening? Do you know?
Well, I just heard Kelly Quinn do a traffic update and say she hasn't seen traffic like this in a while.
Yeah.
And it's not just everybody crawling up to the Cape either, because the Cape doesn't want you up there. You're better off going to the Connecticut beaches. So obviously the highways are getting full. Just look around. Your listeners are out there right now. Look to the right. Look to the left. How many single occupancy vehicles do you see? That's your fellow commuters. Metro North ridership is slowly coming back. At its worst, it was down to 5% of normal. It's now up to 13% of normal. And I think it's going to come back as your listeners looking to the left and the right say, does this make any sense, crawling in traffic like this for, 2 hours a day in each direction? Mm-hmm. The train, I think, is safe. It is clean. It is being well-disciplined mask-wise. And I think people are going to go back to the train if they have to go into the city, although they're not going back as much as they used to.
Yeah, and you know what, Jim? I think if there are any silver linings to this, and I was still taking the train into Manhattan 2 or 3 days a week before this thing got really nasty, but I was on almost deserted cars at the time I was going in, and we all looked at each other saying, my God, even when the cars are deserted, they're never this clean. So let's pray that the MTA gets the message here, Jim, and people like clean rail cars, no matter where they are.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think that the virus is being spread by touching surfaces mm-hmm. that are harboring the virus. I mean, everything that we seem to be learning is that it's mask compliance that is working, that not having somebody cough or sneeze mm-hmm. in your environment and spread those droplets is what's working. Wearing a mask is not a political statement.
No.
It's just a statement that says, I would like to stay alive, okay? I wish our president got that and stopped trying to politicize a solution to a problem that he made worse. But we digress slightly, don't we?
Well, he's and I'm sure his staff has told him, I would be shocked, Jim, as you would too, if they said, Mr. President, why don't you wear a mask? And, how many people's minds change when they're in their mid-70s? So it is what it is, Jim. And, honestly, though.
He's senile? Are you saying?
No, not at all. The other guy may be. No, he's just, come on. I wouldn't give, Jim Cameron, to be a fly on the wall of the Oval Office some days. You talk about, give me popcorn and pork rinds, I'd stay there forever. You, in your latest column, though, you had a few things to say about our esteemed lawmakers here in the great state of Connecticut. Talk a little about that.
Well, I asked the question somewhat rhetorically, where the heck is the legislature? You know, the governor is up to executive order, 327, trying to manage all aspects of this crisis. But where's the legislature been? Well, it's pretty clear they have gone to ground. They're in the bunker. They're in their local district bureau, as you would say. They ran scurrying from the state house after they passed the budget, and they have not come back. And they claim it's because of safety. Well, that is utter BS. I mean, the House of Representatives in Washington has found a way of meeting. All kinds of state legislatures are meeting either virtually or using proxies, etc. They have abrogated their responsibility as the creators of laws in this state and just gone AWOL. Yeah, they've been out doing, mask deliveries and handing out food at food banks and doing everything they can, especially on social media, to remind you that they care about you and they're in your district helping out. That's great. But, volunteers are a dime a dozen. They've been elected to go to Hartford and write laws. So, warning, dear citizens, they are coming back sometime in July. They are going to come back for what's supposed to be a very quick, perfunctory session called the Implementor.
It sounds God, like the that, Terminator. Implementer. Explain the Implementor, because I try to explain that to people sometimes, and they go, huh, what? I said, yes, this happens every session, usually in the dark of night, but please explain that to people.
Well, all the bills that they did pass before they ran scurrying home for safety require, again, I call it a very perfunctory pro forma action to say, okay, we passed the bill, now let's implement it. Let's make it part of law. Do we have to adjust the budget because the need has differed or the budget overall has changed? It's usually a very quick session, but this year, as we've seen in recent years, they're going to turn this into a giant Christmas tree. The leadership of the House and the Senate are going to give all of these members a 500-page document filled with dozens and dozens of bills. They won't have time to read them, let alone understand them, and they have to take the package up or down as a yes or no vote. There's no cutting it open into individual segments. So they either have to take it all or they have to leave it all. And it will be a Christmas tree because some of the ornaments will be very attractive, like if they want to vote on vaccine requirements or police reform or absentee ballots. But stuffed also in that Christmas tree are a few what they call rats, bills that have been stuffed in there that are going to get carried and made into law by the legislature. And they're not going to have the scrutiny of the public. They haven't had public hearings. There hasn't been public debate about them. The public doesn't even know what's in that implementor until after it's implemented by the legislature. And this is not just a fault of the fact that the Democrats have a basically veto-proof majority in both houses. It's a fault of the process. I am sure that if the Republicans had the majority that the Democrats now have, they would be just as abusive of power. It is a process problem that really needs to be resolved, because although some of the bills that they're going to vote on, I think, are very necessary, there are others that are going to slip through, and the end does not justify the means.
And, Jim, you and I have lived in this state for a good many years. We've known each other for a long time, and this was going on back then. It's going on now, and it's probably going to go on, short of a move to change the state constitution or the way the General Assembly operates. What are the odds this is ever going to change, Jim? I don't see it. I just don't.
I think it's particularly egregious and difficult in a time where there is a veto-proof majority of one party or the other, because that's when the leadership of that party can just have its will and do pretty much whatever it wants, even to the dismay of some of the members of their party. I mean, I talked to both Democrats and Republicans. The Republicans are obviously screaming, as you would imagine they are. Mm-hmm. They have, no votes, no power. But I've had Democrats tell me this isn't fair. It's not fair to ask me to go back to my constituents in an election year and explain a vote on something that was really – one of 100 different bills that were packed into this Christmas tree, if you will. and I have to be responsible and deal with an opponent who's going to hold this in my face. So it's just, it's the way that the structure works, and I'm calling it out because I think that the way to change it is, as you said, either by getting rid of veto-proof majorities for either party, making the parties have to work together and be more transparent, and most important of all, engage the public. Don't do this behind closed doors, literally in the dark of night with no notice. Go through the public hearing process. Listen to what people think about these bills. I mean, we know that the legislature, is, in a cowardly move, didn't have the guts to vote on tolls after all that we went through talking about debating tolls.
Yep.
And my opinion swayed from one side to the other. Now what are they going to do? I mean, what's going to be in this Christmas tree?
Exactly. And Jim, finally, you know, you're right. Involve the public. And if you're going to have public hearings, you know what, Jim? Let's not have them at 11 o'clock on a Wednesday morning when most people are working and they hold them in one of the smaller hearing rooms, you know, in the Capitol. I have an idea. Let's do two of them, 7 o'clock on a Tuesday or Thursday of a specific week, and let's hold them in, oh, I don't know, a high school gymnasium, maybe in the central or southern parts of the state where, egad, people can actually stop in, Jim, on the way home and from work. I know I'm talking like a crazy man. I'm sorry.
I absolutely agree. I mean, it would be great to see the legislature come out of its ivory tower in Hartford and come down to this corner of the state, especially when they're dealing with bills that affect our lives. You know, what are we supposed to do? Give up? But I used to have to do this, give up an entire day's work to go up to Hartford, sit in a room, wait until my turn came up, get 3 minutes to testify in a bill, and then, you know, come all the way home.
Wow.
Come down and meet the people. Talk to us on our own terms and at times in locations which are convenient for us.
Jim Cameron, as always, great to talk to you on transportation or politics. Folks, he writes the Getting There column for the Hearst, Connecticut Properties and occasionally delves into politics. He is equally as articulate and as insightful in that area as well. Jim, be good, stay safe, and enjoy the weekend. We'll be in touch, my friend. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to crank up the AC right now.
You, me, buddy, both. Bye-bye. Jim Cameron there.